My name is David Livingston. I am an independent researcher. I've been at it for 35 years, trying to deconstruct many of the lies and propaganda that we've been fed. And that's led me mainly to explore, to investigate the hidden side of history, which is the occult. It's a aspect of history which has been marginalized, neglected by mainstream academics, but it has been foundational. There's, many belief systems have shaped Western history, particularly, of course, Christianity, world history in general. Let's say, Islam or other religions, Buddhism, and so on and so forth. But there is another religion, which is probably as old as many of them. And despite the fact that it's kept secret, has shaped much of Western history. So that includes the history of Zionism, and it overlaps a lot with what I have been investigating. And so the book is called Zionism, the History of a Jewish Heresy. And I basically I go all the way back to the Crusades to look at the early relationship between Jewish Kabbalists and the Crusades, their influence in things like the Legends of the Holy Grail, how that survived over the centuries to evolve into groups like the Rosicrucians, the Freemasons, the Illuminati, so on and so forth, and how these underground occult movements were very closely aligned with the occult heresy of the Messianic mission of Shabtai Zvi, and then from there, how that evolved over the centuries, ultimately to produce the cult of Zionism that we're seeing today.
What you're describing is quite weird. It's like a massive taboo in our modern culture.
Yes, it is, and that speaks to the influence, right? I mean, you're looking at a it's basically, there was a bifurcation that happened in the 1700s, beginning with the influence of Jacob Frank. And so you've got this splitting off from traditional Judaism, which had been practiced for thousands of years by traditional Jews. And then you've got this movement which received some support at some very high level, some very powerful, wealthy Jews, principally people like the Goldsmiths or the Rothschilds. And with that financing, and the influence, biblical influence that they had, they were able to advance their particular brand of Judaism and effectively over time marginalize traditional Judaism. That's basically why today people often, I often hear this question, what is a Jew? Which is totally absurd, right? It was known until very recently that to be a Jew was to be the follower, an obedient follower of the religion of Judaism. If you weren't, or if you were considered a heretic, then you could be excommunicated, which means that you were no longer Jewish. So, with this financial backing, with the power, of course, of interest banking, they gained increasing influence and were able to influence political developments in Europe, to gain access to the publishing, so influence the press, influence literature, influence culture ultimately. And yeah, so that's how they gained power in our time. So their contribution is endemic, really, to what I don't, I don't think Western culture is really quite ready to recognize to what extent it has been shaped by certain nefarious intents.
What about this difference, though, between, as you're kind of describing there, between religious Zionism and political Zionism? They seem very different. They're often deliberately sort of stirred up, mixed up together. Now, there is a very old tradition
But
in it.
I'm not making that distinction. There's three things. There's traditional Judaism, and then there's two different branches of Zionism. So there's, more of the conventional Zionism, and then religious Zionism, which is a more modern invention, which began with Rabbi Cook, who basically tried to, because again, Zionism was contrary to the laws of Judaism. And so religious Zionism was an attempt to sort of co-opt and rehabilitate Judaism to comply with Zionist objectives.
But there is a form of religious Zionism which predates much of this, which is this whole idea of the Amida prayer, which goes back to, I think it's around about 1000 BC, maybe a bit less, but this is this prayer that is prayed in the synagogue to bring us back to Jerusalem. But this is very different, of course, to a sort of political movement or an armed movement to do that. So, I mean, if you're praying to God, that's one thing. But if you're picking up a gun and killing people on the road to taking over Jerusalem, this is not necessarily a God's mission.
No, absolutely not. It basically comes down to what's called the three oaths. And the oaths, one of the three oaths specifically forbid Jews to colonize Palestine. They hope to return to Palestine and to receive the leadership of the Messiah, but it was understood that this was something that they were supposed to wait for patiently and not try to force to happen.
You also mentioned interest there and usury, because this seems to be quite an important element. I mean, we had anti-usury laws, very strict ones in England until the Reformation, and it seems as if much of this has gone. I mean, the allegations against Jews in England in the old days were that they were the only ones who would lend money, and they did it at interest, to non-Jews. But if you look at the history of, for example, the burning of Jews in York, you'll find that the people who wanted them dead were simply really wanting to get rid of debts, you know, by going. And as soon as the Jews had been killed by burning in York, all of the people that had been ringleaders behind it went round to the cathedral, got all the certificates of debt, and burned them all. So there is obviously a motive involved in all of this. It's not just hatred of Jews, it's just not wanting to pay your debts. So what do you make of this sort of idea of the Christian and Muslim and Jewish edicts about banning usury?
Well, I mean, the thing is, that's what's not recognized. I mean, even the Bible says, of course, the Bible forbids usury as well, too, right? Usury is forbidden in every major religion. This is what a lot of people are not aware of. So not only in Judaism and Islam and Christianity, but also in Hinduism and Buddhism. Even Plato was critical. Plato and Aristotle were critical of usury. I think it was Plato or Aristotle, I'm not sure which one, but they describe money as being a means, right? And that it's, so you can't really lend at interest today. It's a ruse. The way I described it is like if you lend somebody a 12-inch ruler, but you say, I want you to give me back. You have to give it back to me in a month, but I want it to be 13 inches. Right? Money is a measure. It's not something that can be increased like that. So that's basically what the con is. But it has a pretty extraordinary money making powers, largely because it is a con and it's not a real investment. It's kind of extortion. And historically what's happened is that the Jews were aware that it was forbidden, but eventually the laws were modified over time so that they permitted themselves to lend. They weren't allowed to lend to themselves, but they were allowed to lend to the non-Jews. And of course, being a marginalized people in most countries, and particularly Europe, money lending was a way for them to, manage to get by, basically, as a marginalized people. So, and it was extortionist. So that's why you find most cases, Jews were kicked out of almost every country of Europe for the longest time, right? They were kicked out of England in 1290. And almost every time the case is, it's usually because of accusations of, their money lending practices.
Okay, well, your book, The Dying God, looks at some of the connections right way back to the Canaanites, etc., of the mystery religions, right the way through to some of the secret societies like Freemasonry today. Yeah. And I wonder what you make of the Druids. I've been reading quite a bit about them recently. Taliesin, who's a bard, writing just a couple of years, 100 years after the Romans extinguished officially the Druid faith. He makes quite a lot of claims about what their values were. They were into human sacrifice. This was something which is a bit uncomfortable for the modern hippies to sort of embrace, and they get romanticized. We've got also this weird thing in the UK where, for example, Winston Churchill was initiated as a Druid. Maybe he just did it for fun, but it wasn't just him. There's quite a few. Yes, Queen Elizabeth was. Another person who was Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. Last but one of the Archbishops of the Church of England. So there's still something going on with this, even if it is just a sort of symbolic organization. So I wonder if what you make of Druids, and also, when you look at some of their practices, it does look as if the Phoenicians, who were trading up and down the eastern Atlantic coasts, right down Africa, out of the Mediterranean, and up as far as Norway, for example, this may be actually their religion.
So, well, yes and no. So, what's very interesting about the Phoenicians, if you look at the account of Herodotus, who wrote in the 5th century BC, about the, he basically explained that the Phoenicians were an Egyptian colony. And he described them as practicing circumcision. So, what's interesting, and this is what I explore quite a bit in The Dying God, like you mentioned, because there's a number of books that are particularly, these are some of the leading scholars on Greek civilization, people like, M.L. West. He wrote a book called The East Face of Helicon. It's a gigantic book. And Walter Rickert, he wrote a number of books. One of them is called The Orientalizing Revolution. Because basically, in Greek civilization, there's two distinct periods. There's the Archaic period and Classical period. And the Archaic period is marked by Near Eastern influences. And the reason why M.L. West called his book The East Face of Helicon is because he points that in part, it's, you know, the Near Eastern influences were particularly prominent in Archaic Greece, but it was Palestine in particular, which was the most influential. So that even that, if you look at the alphabet, our word alphabet, so if there's all the borrowings that the Greeks took from the Phoenicians, one of the first ones was the alphabet. And we still have the words today based on it, but alphabet, this comes from, alpha and beta, which is basically from Hebrew. And so my argument is that clearly what Herodotus is saying is that he is confusing the Phoenicians for Jews. At the time, it wasn't known who the Jews were. And if you look at the entire period particularly after sort of the reign of Solomon, that the Jews were no longer practicing the religion of Judaism, that they were practicing the worship of the dying God, which was, who was known at the time as Baal and Ishtar, sorry. And so basically, the early Jews would have been indistinguishable from the Phoenicians. And I think that basically what we're talking about is when we look at the Phoenician Empire, which was pretty substantial, right, with colonies all the way into Carthage, and they were trading all across the Mediterranean, apparently as far as the Portugal. But in some cases, they say England, that what that would likely have been the early Israelite Empire. There's another interesting book called by Raphael Patai, who's a very famous Jewish historian. It's called, I think it's called The Children of Noah. And that's a very interesting one as well, because he basically looks at early evidence to support the claim that the early Israelite empire could have been a seafaring nation, which would basically connect them to the Phoenicians. So to come back to your point about the Druids, Pliny the Elder, who lived, I'm not sure what century, first century AD, I think is what it was. He wrote one of the most detailed account or criticism, I guess you could say, of the religion of the Magi. Because you guys, you know, it's probably what I detail in my book, The Dying God, is how in the 6th century BC, the Jews were taken into captivity to Babylon, and that's where it developed the early beginnings of what would eventually evolve into the Kabbalah. And to the ancient world, they were known as Magi, the same Magi that I mentioned in the New Testament, who are astrologers who followed the star to discover the location of the Messiah. The Magi basically had an influence. The early influences were in Egypt, contributing to the cult of Hermeticism, and in Greece as a philosophy. So according to Pliny the Elder, he basically, this is what he says. He talks about the Magi and he criticizes them for, you know, being the sort of the first promulgators of magic. And then he says that magic was flourishing to such an extent in England that you would think that it was born there rather than Babylon. And so I think that's where the connection to the Druids begins. And in fact, there's, you know, so one of the most famous, if you look at magic influence in Greece, the two chief exponents of it were Plato and Pythagoras. Pythagoras himself was reputed to have traveled to Babylon to learn under them directly. And so I can't remember whose account it was, but apparently the Druids learned their cult from a student of Pythagoras. So, because when you look at the cult of the Druids, it basically, it's a dying god cult. And so it has a lot of similarities to, you know, the same pagan tradition that would have contributed to the Kabbalah.
So can you just tell us when you decided on this title, what do you actually mean by the dying god? And can you detail some of these Phoenician or Druidic practices? What characterized them?
Yeah, so basically, yeah, when I say the dying god, I mean it's a dying god with a hyphen. And the first person to coin that term was James Frazer. He wrote a book called Golden Bough. Very influential book, and he basically studied the sort of the recurring myth of this dying and resurrecting God, and you find examples of him throughout the ancient Middle East, and he will have different names depending on which civilization he was worshipped in, but usually the myth was always the same, and the myth always involved him descending to the underworld and eventually resurrecting and coming back and defeating a dragon of some sort, a sea monster or something like that. And he was usually a thunder god. But ultimately, basically, you have an early trinity of the creator god, his daughter. And then through his daughter, he has a son. So, and then the son marries his effectively mother and sister, and they become sort of like an androgynous pair. And so that pair is, so the son represents... The sun, S-O-N, is also represents the sun, S-U-N, and his sister, wife, spouse is Venus. And he was believed to, because he represented the sun, then during the winter, he quote-unquote died. And so the crops basically... Yeah, it was a reflection of the season. So the land, the crops would die, and then they would resurrect in the springtime. And all this was timed with the equinoxes, with the cycle of the sun. So that's the two equinoxes and the solstices. And that's why you have the four periods that are important for the worship of this dying God, and that's the Christmas, Easter, St. John's Day, and close to Halloween, which is all, which is the when it was a fall equinox. And because he was a also basically do, yeah, so because he was connected to the underworld, he was, and this is a lot of sort of counter propaganda tries to claim that he was falsely identified with the devil by Christians who you know who were basically trying to castigate anything that was pagan. But the truth is that universally this god was known as a chtonic god, and the chtonic god means he was god of the underworld and usually associated with evil. And because he was associated with the underworld, he was considered to be the ruler of the spirits that lived in the underworld. And this is where our modern idea of ghosts come from, which ghosts are actually demons, but basically they survived as this legend where these departed spirits come from the underworld, and this is also where we get our idea of hell and so on and so forth. So anyway, he was believed to govern the spirits of the dead that resided in Hades or hell at the time. And so because he was believed to be an evil god, then you get this basically ancient pagan cultures differentiated between the two types of worship that were necessary. So for good gods, you had to do good things, and for evil gods, you had to do evil things. So this is where you get the these original black magic, basically, is what it was. Now, rituals that involved, so typically what it involved were sort of some kind of festivity with music, and then some kind of a drug, some kind of intoxicant, either some kind of alcohol or some kind of narcotic. And then so they would basically they would consume these drugs and then play music and dance to sort of whip themselves up in a frenzy to get the spirits to possess them. And this the ancient Greek word for that is called enthusiasmos, which means the god within, the god dwelling within, or something like that. And then so when they would get whipped up in this frenzy and be possessed by the god, then they would usually kill a child and then consume its flesh. And that's basically the origin of what is now referred to as the ancient mysteries. And so this is the cult that when the Jews were brought to Palestine, according to the Bible, they were required, of course, to worship the true God and to avoid falling into the worship of the dying God. And but of course, as we all know, they went against it. And one of the things that the Bible repeatedly accuses them of performing was what is referred to as piercing their children through the fire of Moloch. And Moloch is basically just another name, sort of a derivation of Baal, another dying god who's.
The Old Testament talks a lot about such and such a king presiding over worship in the high places and then being displeasing to Yahweh. So there were quite a lot of those, and not so many Jewish kings of Jerusalem, Jewish
No,
kings anyway, who
exactly.
adhered to these Yahweh Moses rules.
Exactly. So Judaism in those days was a religion for a very, very tiny minority. And prophet after prophet were sent to try to reform them. That so even the temple itself, so this, you know, the temple, Solomon's temple became the center of the Jewish cult, and the temple itself was transformed into a pagan temple. And this is where you get the symbolism of the two pillars, which is central. And yeah, so the pillars basically is a phallic symbol that's to represent the fertility of the dying god. So that's why that's how the ancient Israelites are interchangeable with the Phoenicians. So either they probably it's either the Phoenicians were Israelites or they both existed and they were often confused for one another.
Right. Well, also the Phoenicians have been linked to Egypt and the pharaohs.
Yeah, so the Phoenicians were pretty extraordinarily influential and powerful for a time.
And isn't it
Well,
funny
how is
how
that?
it was funny how the it was actually the Roman Empire, both in England, that extinguished the Druids, and of course through the Punic Wars extinguished the Carthaginians, who were the expression of that Phoenician Empire.
And what's interesting is all the archaeological studies that have been undertaken at Carthage to show all the remains of children who were sacrificed, proving that it's not an invention. But basically what happened is that so the Jews, they were warned that if they didn't desist from this cult, that they would be taken in captivity. So that prophecy was finally fulfilled in 599, when they were taken to captivity, 599, 596, somewhere around there, taken in captivity into Babylon. And what seems to have happened there is that this dying god cult then was now mixed with the Babylonian magic, because there's a whole sort of a tradition of astral magic that existed in Babylon, omen astrology, omen astralism, or I'm not sure what you call it. But basically, this is where you get this merger of this, but it's effectively in the 6th century in Babylon that astrology was invented. So this combination of astrology, magic, and the dying god worship, it became this cult now that we're experiencing today. It wasn't called Kabbalah at the time, but it's where Kabbalah had its origins.
Because there are these two Talmuds, aren't there? The Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud. It's almost like there's been a tug of war, really, for control of the Jewish faith for literally thousands of years.
This Gershom Scholem refers. He's the one who sort of identified this tradition, and so where you find it first is among the Essenes, and what Gershom Scholem. He refers to it as Jewish Gnostics. So these at the time were Jewish heretics. And so this didn't in any way, there's always basically this twin path in Judaism, right? You've got the sort of more traditional religion, and it wasn't necessarily never uncorrupted, but it's separate. That corruption camp is not to be confused with the separate tradition of the Kabbalah. And so, because if you look at all the early Christian Gnostic sects, they were all tended to be Jewish, particularly groups like the Ophites, who were basically serpent worshippers. And so what's curious is that the Kabbalah only emerges in the 1200s, sorry, 12th century, in the late 1100s. And what puzzles people like Gershom Scholem is, how is it that a tradition which had been marginalized for 1,000 years up until that point, all of a sudden was fully and openly and boldly expressed in some of the literature that emerged at the time? So this Kabbalist tradition, again, was a heretical tradition that for a long, long time was marginalized. And it's really only, I'm not an expert on this subject, but from what I understand, it's beginning 1100s that begins to start to gain some ascendance. And then it's slowly, slowly over the centuries starts to gain more and more influence, but it was always pretty marginal. And it's only particularly with people like Isaac Luria that it really starts to really grow in influence. And then, of course, most importantly, with movements like that of Shabtai Zvi and Jacob Frank.
Well, so you're describing this religion, which is trying to hang on in there, which is the foundation of Christianity and Islam eventually. The idea is you've got the Ten Commandments. This is a moral code. You've got the one God named Yahweh. Various people give it sort of slightly different, like Jehovah, this kind of thing. But as against that, you were describing yourself this idea of different gods, you know, evil gods and good gods. So is it fair to say that old, you know, the pantheistic idea of lots of different gods, you kind of pick and choose whichever one you want, isn't that kind of expressed through Hinduism today?
I don't know. I'm not that familiar with Hinduism. There's pagan traditions and there's Satanism, and then some elements of paganism are satanic, but paganism itself is not satanic, right? There's neo-paganism today, which is trying to hijack pagan tradition, but in reality is just Satanism. So I'm not sure. I'm not familiar enough with Hinduism to be able to characterize it, because what we're talking about here, the dying god worship, is specifically it's the thing is, right, Satan is worshipped even in non in in traditions that were not Judeo-Christian, right? That's basically what we're talking about. So the Phoenicians would have worshipped a brand of, Phoenicians, the Egyptians, the Greeks, and even there, I'm not sure how widespread. Because what's really interesting is that there's a case, there was a leak, there's a problem in Rome, and I can't remember what years it was, in the 300s or 200s, where a mystery cult was exposed, and they were banned by the Roman government. And if you read the description by Livy, who described the rites that were taking place, and it's just awful, right? Basically, he says that these people get together in the hills and they murder and they practice orgies and they, all kinds of evils, and it was considered repugnant. And this is by a government which is pagan itself.
I suppose we've got quite a lot to thank the Romans for in that case,
Yeah.
exposing these things. But
Well,
you're
it was.
describing this interesting tradition. So to begin with, you've got like prehistoric kind of power cults around killing your opponents. That is becomes a sort of ritualized around human sacrifice. So
Right.
then you, when it comes to Judaism, with a bit of help from Moses and his pals, you begin to have a move to animal sacrifice only, and finding human sacrifice totally not on in that tradition. And then with Christ and also of course with Muhammad, you have an idea that, well, actually you don't really need to have any of these sacrifices of animals at all, that there's something higher. So it does seem as at least as if over the thousands of years, civilization has moved forward a little bit.
Except that we have the United States has Donald Trump as their president, so
Well, what does he represent? He doesn't do animal sacrifice, does he? Or human sacrifice?
no, he just shows that what a dead end human civilization has achieved, right? We've got a guy who's basically like the just a complete scoundrel, unintelligent, self-obsessed, no scruples, who's leading a country, run by, like, you talked about it, like basically they're run by feudal lords, and who keep their who think the masses are revolting, who deliberately keep their serfs ignorant and hungry.
Actually, I have to take it back, David, because there
Yeah.
is human sacrifice going on, of course,
Of
and there
course.
has been in Gaza. It looks like there might be some human sacrifice about to take place too in Venezuela.
Right. Yeah. And of course, there's lots of human sacrifice that happens. They say satanic rituals.
Sorry, can you just explain what you mean by that?
Well, I mean, that's what Satanism is all about, right? Satanism is consciously a survival revival of the ancient mysteries, right? They all trace themselves back to the Eleusinian mysteries or the Dionysian mysteries, the Bacchanals. Well, it's interesting that there's a famous Greek philosopher. His name is Heraclitus, who lived in 6th century BC in the 500s, and he describes. So basically, what happens is that the Magi influence, their influence manifested in ancient Greece as the cult of Orpheus, or what's called the cult called Orphism, and he says that the cult of Orphism was conducted in imitation of the Magi, and he said that it was an infernal cult dedicated to the phallus. So you see, basically, this is the same thing. It's just that's basically that's all it is. It's just modern Satanism. It's just that was the earliest, a very early version of Satanism, and it's come under many different names through history. So it's come under the names of Greek philosophy in some cases, of Neoplatonism, of Hermeticism, of Gnosticism, of course, and then has always sort of disguised itself as a marginal philosophizing tradition. You have alchemy, of course, through the Middle Ages, and all that was always linked to Hermeticism and astrology and Neoplatonism and so on, you know, so on and so forth. And that's how Satanism has basically maintained its disguise and survived and carried out. Well, this is the formative influence that I've been talking about on Western civilization. This is the cult that has been carried, you know, semi hidden, right? Because it's the rites, the true significance is hidden, but there is always some level of it being somewhat, you know, revealed to the public, but never, of course, the darker aspects of it.
Well, I mean, it's so fascinating here in Britain, David, mm-hmm. because we had in the 1980s Geoffrey Dickinson, and as a member of Parliament, Conservative, and actually in the noughties too, there was an enormous what they call VIP defile scandal. A lot of this involved quite clear evidence of satanic ritual abuse going on. Now, whether this actually was satanic or whether it is just the idea is just to traumatise children and to then use them for blackmailing through paedophilia, and it's difficult to tell. But I mean, I think we need to try and understand in a sort of non-spiritual way what's going on in the head of people. So you've got a sort of divide mostly between, I think, pretty much every individual on planet Earth has got a sort of spiritual divide of their own of some sort, yeah. between being public spirited, like giving up themselves for the public good, for the greater good. And then you've got the more selfish types, but then you've also got the selfish ones who are crafting everything they possibly can to appear to be the public spirited ones. So where do these Satanists and others fit into that?
Well, that's what it is, right? It's a war of God against, it's a war of Satan against God. And has been for centuries, right? So you have certain followers who basically join his party. You know, the idea of selling their souls to the devil. They basically choose to side with him against God. And you know, I'm not saying this as by analogy or but consciously that's what they're doing. This is why Milton. John Milton is so important to all of them, right? This is how they interpret what they're doing. They're consciously opposing God, who this is the same way the Gnostics did. So come back to your question.
Well, I mean, it's just that some of these individuals, they seem to be sort of, they think, well, there is no God, but so I may as well be selfish. And then think, well, actually, maybe there is a God, and maybe there's almost like a sort of religion around selfishness.
Right. So, yes, there's some people who are, who don't believe in God and may do evil. But there are people who are consciously, who believe in God, but reject him in favor of Satan. Just as Satan believes in God, right? Satan is not an atheist, right? Satan is not an atheist.
Well, I suppose we could also say there are people that don't believe in God, but are also public-spirited and kind, you know? So there's all sorts out there.
Of course, but yeah, I mean, that's why God's the judge, right? We're not here to, like, condemn anybody. We don't know. We can't look into people's hearts, though, to know, you know, who's good and who's bad. That's not what it's about, right? But we know what is good and what is bad, and that's what we have to do. We have to align ourselves with what's good, and we know that good is to care, to have compassion, to respect, to valorize. And Satanism is the opposite. Satanism basically rejects God, so they reject good. They don't think that it's worth their time showing any kind of compassion to their fellow human being. On the contrary, they think that they're entitled to exploit them, lie to them, deceive them, and manipulate them in whatever they see fit. And they believe that their choice to do so is representative of their superiority over the rest of them. And that's why fundamentally it's an elitist ideology. And that's why Satanism is expressed as fascism.
Not communism?
Liberalism.
Not communism?
No. No.
Well, because they're both quite similar. They're both authoritarian in many ways.
Yeah. But where's communism now?
Well, some would say that communism is in China and it's triumphed over capitalism.
Right. Communism is a lie that China has been holding on to. They know very well that there's it's not communism. If you look, basically the conspiracy that we experienced the last 150 years or so has been a fascist conspiracy, because Satanism is expressed as fascism. And that's why everywhere you look, just if you want to trace the conspiracy from the early 1900s all the way up to Trump, it's a fascist cabal, fascist and Nazi, and Kabbalistic and Gnostic at all at the same time. That's why you get somebody like Nick Land. He's a perfect example of confluence of all those traditions all in one person. Same thing with Dugin. That's why they're part of the same tradition. If you look at all of them, they're all Kabbalists and Nazis at the same time. And this basically is the essence of my book on Zionism.
Right. Are they not? Are they Zionists at the same time?
Generally, yeah.
And so do you have any truck with this idea of this kind of what's been the term that's been coined, Pax Judaica? I mean, I think probably it would possibly be should be called Pax Zionica. The idea that the Zionists are creating the next great empire of the world.
Of course. Did I ever read to you what Ben Gurion said? I think as far back as 19. So no, he said in 1962. So I'm quoting now. The image of the world in 1987 as traced in my imagination, : the Cold War will be a thing of the past. Internal pressure of the constantly growing intelligentsia in Russia for more freedom and the pressure of the masses for raising their living standards may lead to a gradual democratization of the Soviet Union. On the other hand, the increasing influence of the workers and farmers and the rising political importance of men of science may transform the United States into a welfare state with a planned economy. Western and Eastern Europe will become a federation of autonomous states having a socialist and democratic regime, with the exception of the USSR as a federated Eurasian state. All other continents will become united in a world alliance, at whose disposal will be an international police force. All armies will be abolished and there will be no more wars. In Jerusalem, the United Nations, in brackets, a truly United Nations, will build a shrine to the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the Supreme Court of mankind to settle all controversies among the federated continents as prophesied by Isaiah.
Right. So that's sort of spelling out the plan, I suppose.
Yeah.
Now, in order to carry that out, we have a sort of tyranny at the moment of finance, the destruction of the mass media, the strangulation of journalism. I remember Richard Cottrell. He was a conservative member of the European Parliament for the Southwest. He was also the editor of the in-house magazine for the British Aircraft Corporation, which was quite famous in the 1950s, 60s, 70s as Building Concord, you know. So he was quite an interesting, influential guy. So, you know, he said all sorts of things relating to this, I mean, which are, it's escaped me now for some annoying reason. I can dig them out. But what we're dealing with is a system which is slowly, that's right. He said that journalism is dead. There is no actual journalism going on. He's someone that was brought up in that era and he saw it dying in the 1990s, and he pronounced it dead around about 2010. He said there's actually no real journalism going on at all. Of course, there is a little bit around the fringes, but no proper investigations going on really at all that get to the heart of anything that really affects society in the future. And this sort of lines up with you talking about Nick there, Nick Land, my old school friend, who is in a peculiar way did bring me to God, because the questions he raised and the ideas that he had when we were, I suppose the year would be around about 1977, at Langley Park, he prompted me to really think about this idea of whether there's a God or not. And in fact, I grabbed him, that would probably be 1979, and said to him, Nick, is there such a thing as God? What do you think? I know what I think. Mm-hmm. What do you think? And he, because he always gave a straight answer. He really did. You know, he was very good like that.
Right.
He didn't used to cheat either at the war games we played, but at least, no, because I checked, I go back and see, has he moved the pieces around over since last weekend? And he didn't. So I trusted him very much in this. Anyway, so he gave his opinion. Well, it's about 50-50, Tony. But it does seem he's more recently come out as being much more leaning towards the satanic points of view. He's a Manichaean. He talks about Manichaeanism. But anyway, look, just getting to the point, he wrote something in ran about, I think, in 2017, called A Quick and Dirty Introduction to Accelerationism. And I'll quote from him now. Anyone trying to work out what they think about accelerationism better do so quickly. That's the nature of the thing. It was already caught up with trends that seemed too fast to track when it began to become self-aware decades ago. It's picked up a lot of speed since then. Accelerationism is old enough to have arrived in waves, which is to say insistently or recurrently, and each time the challenge is more urgent. Amongst its predictions is the expectation that you'll be too slow to deal with it coherently. Yet if you fumble the question it poses because rushed, you lose, perhaps very badly. It's hard. For our purposes here, you are standing in as a bearer of the opinions of mankind. Time pressure, by its very nature, is difficult to think about. Typically, while the opportunity for deliberation is not necessarily presumed, it is at least, with overwhelming likelihood, mistaken for a historical constant rather than a variable. If there was ever time to think, we think, there still is and always will be. The definite probability, the allotment of time to decision-making, is undergoing systematic compression, a neglected consideration even among those paying explicit and exceptional attention to the increasing rapidity of change. So he's really saying that they're way ahead of us, and everything we try and do is pointless. There is no alternative. There is going to be a total control and ownership by the people with money. They will just basically run and own everything. Capital will be sovereign.
So, I mean, we're talking about Satanists, right? So that's this is very important to remember, that Satanists are not atheists. And they believe in the existence of God, Jehovah, of the Bible. They believe in this, in the history of the Bible. They believe in the prophecies of the Bible, but they choose the opposing camp. So what they're trying to do, and this is what Ben-Gurion is describing, is they're trying to bring about the fulfillment of, this is what Zionism is, right? This is what we are saying, is that it's Zionism is the idea that you can force the hand of God, that you have to make prophecies happen. This goes back to Isaac Luria. He's the first one, well, probably not the first one, but he's the first prominent one to propose that idea. I'm going to read you from something from Nick's friend, his new best friend, Dugin. So in the fourth political theory, Dugin said, the end times and the eschatological meaning of politics will not realize themselves on their own. We will wait for the end in vain. The end will never come if we wait for it, and it will never come if we do not. This is essential because history, time, and reality have special strategies to avoid judgment day, or rather, they have a special strategy, a revolutionary maneuver that will create the impression that everyone has come to a realization and understanding. This is the huge arsenal of Heidegger's noch nicht, or eternal not yet. If fourth political practice is not able to realize the end times, then it would be invalid. The end of days should come. It will not come by itself. It is a task. It is not a certainty. It is active metaphysics. It is a practice.
And is Dugin approving of that? Is he just observing it?
No, that's his belief system. This is the basis of Dugin's whole philosophy, which he's called the Empire of the End Times. Right. This is where it gets really, really complicated. If you understand all these people, how they all connect together, and this is where Lange's acceleration comes in. So this is all goes back. So, you know, we talked about there's many manifestations of Satanism in many forms, like Hermeticism, so on and so forth. Right. The most recent one in our century is traditionalism. This is a whole idea that goes all the way back to the Renaissance, but most recently was popularized by René Guénon, and then has, like, you know, various modifications over the centuries, and it's very closely related to fascism. And Dugin is really the modern exemplar of this whole tradition, and it links all kinds of people. If you look at Dugin's friends, so he's friends all over the place. We talked about this before. I'm not going to repeat, you know, all the connections that he has, but basically he's very much at the center of the Luciferian International. And one of the key organizations that to publicize a lot of this traditionalist thinking is a publishing company called Inner Traditions. And so this is where you get the whole nexus of all these people. A lot of the people who are associated with sort of the ancient aliens nonsense, a lot of the sort of like these, what they call New Egyptologists, you know, sort of a lot of the New Age mumbo jumbo. They also publish Evola's books. Dugin is a major proponent of Julius Evola. And this is now where you start to see the link now to the accelerationist movement. Nick is considered really sort of the godfather, modern godfather of accelerationism, but it really goes back to a guy named James Mason in a magazine that he used to operate called The Siege. And so James Mason was a member of the American Nazi Party for a while, and then he befriended Charles Manson, and they created some kind of publication together. I can't remember what it was called. And So he was the first to promote this idea of accelerationism, but it really goes back to Charles Manson and the whole idea of the Process Church. So again, the Process Church now with many, many links, right? I recommend anybody who's looking into it to read Maury Terry's book. There's also a half-decent documentary about him on Netflix if you want to give a vague idea of what his research is about, but it's really amazing. So if you want to talk about what sadism looked like today and, you know, satanic ritual abuse, he treats all that in its connection to the Process Church, because that's what Manson was inspired by. What's really interesting is that, what's her name? I can't remember what her name was. The two founders, the female founder, something McLean, Marianne McLean, I think is what it was on the founder, and de Grimstone, who were the founders of the Process Church. So she was actually one of the many sort of ladies that were pimped by a guy named, now I can't remember his name, but who basically was behind the Profumo scandal. And so he basically operated out of the Cliveden House, I think it was called, a mansion that used to be owned by the Astor family. This traces back to, so Lady Astor is a whole connection to the Cliveden set. They were all part of the sort of network of collaborationists during, or, you know, what's the word, appeasers, or who were trying to find appeasement with the Nazi Germany. Eventually, he inherited the right to live, I guess, or to at least use the Cliveden house, which is where he held, according to what's her name? The lady who was at the center of the Profumo scandal. She described basically these.
That's Christine Keeler. Yeah.
Thank you. That's her. She described these, what she called Masonically themed black magic parties. And so he was also friends with Billy Hitchcock, who funded Timothy Leary's stay at the Millbrook Mansion in Maine, which sort of became his headquarters. So of course now the whole idea of what Manson was trying to do with the killings, the killing of Sharon Tate and that whole group was to basically to ignite a race war that would effectively accelerate our move towards the end times. And what's interesting, of course, is that Sharon Tate was the wife of Roman Polanski, who was the director of Rosemary's Baby, which featured Anton LaVey, who was the head of Church of Satan. Rosemary's Baby was produced by Robert Evans, who was connected to Roy Redd and who was one of the leaders, according to Murray Terry, of the Process Church. So just to say that this is the whole network that we're talking about. So now Siege had a particular, this, I go to all this, anybody's looking for it, I go through all this in a chapter called The Black Order in volume 5 of my Ordo Abcal book. And this is where you see James, now we're back to James Mason, who was friends with Charles Manson, and the influence of his Siege publication on a number, this whole sort of satanic network that connects back to Dugan. People like Boyd Rice, who was a friend of Anton LaVey. You've got this other guy, his name is, what's his name? Moynihan something. Moynihan collaborated with Inner Traditions, right, in the publication of Evola's Among the Ruins. Boyd was the founder of a social Darwinist think tank called the Abraxas Foundation. Of course, Abraxas was a very well-known demonic god of Gnosticism. He was also friends with a guy named Nicholas Schreck, who married the daughter of Zena, the daughter of Anton LaVey. So this is now this whole network that basically like connects to the black metal scene and all this stuff, and most importantly, the Order of Nine Angles. And so this is where really the sort of the crux of the modern manifestation of accelerationism is taking place. And now Nick Land himself has been promoting the publications of the Order of Nine Angles. The representative of the O9A in Australia is Kerry Bolton, who is a friend of Alexander Dugan. And again, in my chapter on them, it's a chapter now, volume 6 of my Order book called Techno-Libertarianism. This is where I talk about the whole connection between Peter Thiel, Nick Land, accelerationism, an entire sort of neo-Nazi network of terrorists who all have links back to Dugan.
Well, look, it's one of those interesting, weird things about Nick is his father was from South Africa. At least he'd been working for a long time there as a director of the oil company Shell. And he wound up living in a house on Hayes Common near Hayes railway station and coming to our school, Langley Park, on the train every day. So it's an interesting, a lot of this stuff does go back to South Africa, it seems to. Obviously Musk, you know, there's a whole list of things, because it was a British Empire haven during Nazism. The idea was that you couldn't be a Nazi in Britain, you really couldn't, it was, you know, extremely difficult. So the South Africans provided a place for people to go, and it seems like it was a sort of incubator. My book on the Fourth Reich obviously is of some interest here, because what they were doing down there, it seems that the Bormann and others who had got all the wealth of Europe that they'd looted during the Second World War started feeding that into this secret financial empire, the 750 companies that were created by Bormann over in Buenos Aires, most of them, and then he was in Buenos Aires. He was creating them all around, mostly around the Western world. And then the money was laundered through the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm, which was the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York, into these businesses. And the most important thing is that they decided they were going to put Jews in as chairman of most of these companies in order to disguise the fact that it was Nazi money that had populated them. So, you know, this does, it does seem to be a quite a small bunch of people involved in all of this.
Nazism is the underlying thread. Nazism is basically just the face of Satanism. It's a public face of Satanism.
Well, they did talk about it in the Second World War as the Crooked Cross, didn't they, the swastika?
Right.
So it's like you're taking the Christian cross and you're snapping each part of it. Yeah. And so, yeah, quite clearly, I mean, I think it wasn't it Rauschning, Dennis Wheatley quotes Rauschning, who was friendly with Hitler's circle in the run-up to the Second World War and then came to Britain and started writing. He said, well, this is what the guy is. He said that Rauschning had decided, when he came to Britain, he explained that Hitler was like a prototype for the Antichrist. So, you know, see, this is how it fits in possibly with
that's
the...
That's what it is. It's a satanic Antichrist conspiracy. The first to use the to adopt the swastika was Prince Charles of Hessen-Cassel. And so, again, this is a family. He was the heir of a family that were the principal supporters of Martin Luther and then the Rosicrucian movement. Their family, who this is why it's so important that they trace their descent back to Philip the First, Landgrave of Hesse, who again traced his descent back to the Night Swan of the that was popularized by Wagner, Hitler's favorite composer. His brother was the one who gave Amschel Bauer his start in his career, who later changed his name to Rothschild. He was also the one who granted the charter, if I remember, or basically he was the one who backed the founding of what's called the Frankfurt Judenlodge, which was the first Jewish lodge to allow Jews to enter from a Masonic lodge for Jews in Frankfurt. And basically that's really the network where you get the birth of all kinds of movements, because it was mostly joined by members of the Asiatic Brethren, who were all mostly followers of Jacob Frank, most of them disciples of Moses Mendelssohn, who was the father of modern Judaism, especially Judaism and ultimately Zionism. And so Prince Charles of Hesse-Kassel, he's the one who introduced the swastika from Indian tradition, Hindu tradition, Far Eastern tradition, maybe even Buddhist tradition, because he believed that it was a symbol to represent reincarnation, which was equivalent to the idea of Gilgul, the version of reincarnation found in the Kabbalah. And so the two symbols began to be used simultaneously, the swastika to represent the Gilgul of the Kabbalah and the Star of David, which was a medieval magical symbol, also known as the Seal of Solomon, which was supposed to be the seal that Solomon used to control the jinn, the demons, in his practice of magic.
Yeah, looking at some of these traditions, I think it's fascinating. I mean, for example, with the Illuminati, you can see that the original helper of Adam Weishaupt, once he was uncovered as a conspirator and sacked from his job, I think it was at Ingolstadt University, it was the local Duke of Saxe-Gotha. Now, that's right. Funny, because that's the same family as the British royal family.
He was the grandfather of Prince Albert. Was it Prince Albert that she married, Queen Victoria? The husband of Queen Victoria.
Yeah.
So he was the grandfather of the husband of Queen Victoria.
Yeah, so this is, yes, it's a small, kind of tiny group of people behind a lot
small,
of this.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you mentioned small, James Fraser earlier, and, you know, he did such an amazing job with the Golden Bough, I think, you know, to dig into a lot of these traditions. Someone else's, Margaret Murray, she wrote a book called The Witch Cult in Western Europe, which I think was absolutely devastatingly brilliant. No one was expecting her to write this, because she was actually an Egyptologist, but she started getting more and more interested in the Druidic traditions and witchcraft traditions in Europe and in Britain. And then she came out, I think, about 10 years off, maybe it was about 1930s, this, with another book called The God of the Witches, which look very closely at evidence about from witchcraft trials. You know, now obviously we know some of those witchcraft trials would have been vindictive, but there was also quite powerful evidence that was coming out.
Satanic tradition.
But you know, many of the people were given freely given confessions because they'd felt they were in a cult, and this was a way of kind of escaping the cult by turning king's evidence or queen's evidence or whatever, as there was a changeover in the traditions from the old Vatican Catholic tradition in England to and Scotland, obviously, and to the Protestant faith. And this was one of the things that had been festering for years, the problems with the Catholic protection of witchcraft cults on the Vatican. Sorry, not, I shouldn't say the Catholics. It was the Vatican that was doing this. Anyway, so we've got James Fraser, we've got Margaret Murray. Are there any other people who you think deserve like a big thumbs up and a bit of a medal for the massive, amazing work that they've done over the last century or so?
Oh, there's too many to mention. Some of them are not, they're not on our side, but of course there's Frances Yeats. She really broke the ground, I think. She's really the one, I think, who made the study of Western occultism respectable. She did an extraordinary study on the Rosicrucian movement. And Rosicrucian Enlightenment, but there's also several other books that she wrote. I think Gershom Scholem, too. Gershom Scholem, his scholarship was outstanding. But, you know, he was partial to the Sabbatian tradition. So he's biased, but still... an extraordinary scholar.
And there is also, of course, this sort of knotty question of the Protocols of Zion, which were released, I think, by the Tsar's secret police not long before the Russian Revolution and the head chopping of the Tsar. So what do you make of that? Because this is quite controversial. It was used by Hitler quite a bit, wasn't it, the Protocols?
Absolutely. So this is a central theme in my books, because the person who published the Protocols was a guy named Sergei Nilus, and he received them from a woman called Yuliana Glinka, and so she was a disciple of Elena Blavatsky. She's also worked for the Russian Secret Service, the Okhrana, in Paris. She was also part of an entire network that included people like Juliet Adams. And Juliet Adams, another disciple of Pappas. But they were also all friends with a guy named William T. Stead, who was a founding member of the Cecil Rhodes Roundtable. There's an excellent article, it's in German, but I can't remember what this title, by Marcus Osterreiter, who's also he's also one of my favorite scholars, actually. And he's the first one who pointed out all these connections to me. And he basically suggests that what the Protocols were revealing was actually the plots of the Round Table. So it's very mysterious. So when you look at the Protocols, they were also based, they're a forgery, of a book by Maurice Joly. But Maurice Joly was himself a member of the Memphis Mizraim Masonic Rite, and the head of that was Adolf Kremer, who basically was, one of the early most influential Zionists. He was the Grand Master of the Memphis Mizraim. He was also one of the founders of the Alliance Israélite Universelle, which is, again, one of the most important early Zionist organizations. And so it's all very mysterious how it came together. But what's most revealing is that they were disseminated by a guy named Boris Brassol. And he's a really, really, really mysterious character. He was basically a Russian triple agent. You know, Russians were at the time were conducting what they called Operation Trust, and that was to promote anti-communism, to sort of entrap potential dissidents. So his he first exercised it through it. So apparently, according to one of his good friends, his collaborators, he was a crypto Jew. But then he ended up in with a lot of other white Russian opponents of the Bolsheviks in Nazi Germany, and they founded a movement called the Aufbau. And the Aufbau included all kinds of people, especially two Thule Society members, which was Erich von Ludendorff and Alfred Rosenberg, who's, of course, the chief ideologue of the Nazi movement. And it's from him that the Nazis learned about the protocols and that Hitler eventually used it as his, what Norman Cohn referred to as his warrant for genocide. So, you know, if you look at, you know, yeah, so this is the pretext that Hitler used to carry out his war against all the poor Jews of the world, right? Like cobblers and shopkeepers, and while he is basically receiving money from people like the Warburgs and the Rockefellers. But Boris Brassel then finds his way to the United States, and then he was referred to as, quote unquote, the brain trust of the America First Committee. So the reason why America First is so much in the news these days, it was, of course, first originally popularized by Trump, is because it's a revival of this concept that was originally a Klan slogan that was adopted by the America First Committee, which was basically a neo-Nazi front founded in the late 40s, in the 40s or late 30s, I guess, I can't remember what year exactly, but it was founded to lobby to keep the United States out of the war. And so out of the America First Committee, you get the American Security Council, which has been described as, quote unquote, heart of the American military industrial complex. The JFK, this is why JFK assassination is so central, because it was a plot that was carried out by Israel through a front called Permindex, which had all kinds of fascist links worldwide, and with a team of rogue agents of the CIA headed by a guy named Ted Shackley, sometimes they're also known as Operation 40, in league with the Klan, in league with the John Birch Society. And this is really see how this underground fascist right in the United States really sort of began to coalesce and coordinate and start to build their influence and agenda. During the Vietnam War, they moved into the Far East and headed the Golden Triangle heroin trade. Then finally in the 80s, that evolved into Iran-Contra. And that's where you get this whole cabal of pro-Israeli neocons working with the Fascist International, particularly groups like the Cercle, Le Cercle, Lupine Circle, all behind, again, the Iran-Contra operation. And then so it's that network, which is the backbone of an organization today in the United States called the Council for National Policy, also, or the CNP. And that's really where the base of Trump's support is derived from, and why he is currently the mouthpiece for this America First, effectively a neo-Nazi agenda. It's no accident that Elon Musk did a Nazi salute at the inauguration.
Yeah, but those two seem to have fallen out now. Maybe this is another bit of smoke, mirrors. Well, I think I also ought to point out, I don't know if you've come across this drama series, but the BBC produced in 90, or maybe it was ITV produced in 1983. I think it was Euston Films. And it's called Riley Ace of Spies. It talks about the right. trust you were talking about here.
He collaborated with Boris Brassel.
And Sidney Riley was a spy. Mm-hmm. No one quite ever seemed to work out who he was working for. The British were very frustrated. The Germans were frustrated. He was a sort of pre-runner for James Bond, I suppose. But it was based on a book by Robin Bruce Lockhart called Ace of Spies. The screenplay was by Troy Kennedy Martin, who was an absolutely fantastic. And he was Sidney Riley is played in that series by Sam Neill. A terrific, lost, never repeated, hardly ever seen, but it's well worth a look. And it really does go into this idea that you can create these organisations that appear to be nationalistic in the face of some kind of threat to the existence of the nation. But actually, it's totally controlled by the Secret Services. Everything is being watched and maneuvered by a sort of war party who you're never quite sure who they are. I think if you ask Sidney Reilly, he'd probably tell you. But anyway, David, I just wonder if you can wind up by saying something about the, how listeners can get hold of your stuff, whether it's in printed paperbacks or ebooks or whatever, and follow your work.
Thanks, Tony. Yeah, so my website is called ordoapcal.ca, and that's where I keep information about all of my, I think I've got 7 books now. A few of them you can read entirely online. So that's the 5 volumes of Ordo Apcal, the Zionism book, and my latest book, which is called Divide and Conquer, Muslims versus Islam. 2 volumes of that are available online as well. Or you can order, there's links to order it, a paper version on Amazon. I think there's audiobook versions for most of my books now as well, too. I also have a link to my Patreon page. And so that's where I don't do Facebook. I don't do Twitter. Patreon is basically where I interact with my readers, and I post, regular updates and what's happening and share my findings and things like that. So thank you.
Okay, David Livingston, thanks very much for joining us again.
Great. Thank you very much, Tony. Always a pleasure.